Okay.
Thank you, everyone, for coming today. It's my pleasure to introduce Tiffany Vino from the University of Michigan, both in the Information School there, or School of Information, is that how they say it there?
Yes.
And also Public Health. She has a wide variety of interests that I think all relate to biomedical and health informatics here, particularly related to some of my research interests, looking at health information acquisition, sharing and use in communities and families, also looking at appropriation or domestication of health information technologies within communities and families. She's published her research in Journal of Documentation, Canadian Association for Information Science, American Society for Information Science and Technology, and Association for Library and Information Science and Education. She has grants from Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, the VA, the Michigan Institute for Clinical and Health Research, the Institute for Museum and Library Services, the Canadian Institutes for Health Research, Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, Canadian Foundation for AIDS Research, and Ontario HIV Treatment Network. And she also is serving on the Biomedical Library and Informatics Review Committee at the National Library of Medicine, which is great fun and tons of work.
Yes.
Today, I know it's challenging. Today we're going to hear about Tiffany's great research on how community matters for health informatics. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. So thank you all for coming today. It's really wonderful to see such a full room. This is the title of my talk. I'm going to be making a case to you today for community health informatics as an approach. And this is generally what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about how I found my way into this work, the general research program I'm pursuing, and then some of the central findings that I have had. So just to sort of ground where I'm coming from, I got my master's degree in 1994, and I went out and started working primarily in the nonprofit sector. And one of the organizations I started to work with was focused on HIV treatment information, and it was a national nonprofit that was consumer-driven. So it came out of the AIDS movement, etc. And it really was an organization that kind of is an artifact of this demographic fact, which was that in Canada, since the beginning of the epidemic, a specific population has had a disproportionate amount of HIV. And that is the MSM population, or gay and bisexual men and people that don't identify. So the organization, because of this incredible amount of health disparities that was existing in the population, there was an activist movement called AIDS Action Now, which was kind of like our Canadian version of ACT UP. And that organization was part of founding the organization that I ultimately worked for, which was called the Canadian AIDS Treatment Information Exchange. And the organization had a number of different services. We had telephone treatment information counseling. We had a website. We had a number of consumer publications, a library, etc. And this organization was very successful for a number of years. It moved from an organization with just two people in the nonprofit sector locally to becoming a nationally funded organization and was very popular for a long time. But then something happened. The organization started to face the fact that HIV was changing demographically. The organization, the disease was starting to disproportionately affect Aboriginal populations, immigrant communities, injection drug users, populations that were not necessarily ones that the organization was typically accustomed to serving. And when I joined the organization, which was around 2000, right here, we were starting to get a lot of complaints from stakeholders that we weren't necessarily serving their needs well. There were a lot of problems with our service model. It wasn't what people needed. And usage was dropping like a lead balloon is the metaphor. So basically, the organization was in a lot of struggle. And part of what I took on in my work as Director of Information Services, which included the website, our library services, and things like that, I really started to take on this problem of how do you engage and reach these diverse populations. And I really learned at that time that there were sort of ongoing problems with reach and impact for marginalized communities across multiple kinds of information technologies and services. So most of you probably know that there's still about 20% of adults in the U.S. that don't use the internet at all. not, and there are certain demographic factors that are predicted of that. Similarly, race is an important predictor of adoption of EHR technologies, and it often goes over and above internet access differentials. Similarly, in terms of health communications, there have been a lot of studies now that have shown around HIV, smoking, a whole range of areas, that programs are typically less effective with people who are lower SES. So this particular problem is also one that we see that overlaps with populations that experience disparities. And so when I came to the United States, I also discovered that in addition to the MSM population, for example, African Americans and Latinos were experiencing disproportionate rates of new HIV infections. And moreover, so this number here shows that African Americans are dying a lot faster of the disease. So this particular sort of problem, I was observing that there was an overlap at the same time between populations that are not necessarily using or being reached by health information, as well as populations experiencing disparities. And moreover, those disparities tend to cluster geographically. So this is a map showing an area that I work in, which is Detroit. This looks at diabetes prevalence. We see the area in red is a higher rate of diabetes prevalence. And so we see diseases that are tending to be clustered, and that's an area that's predominantly African American. Detroit is 92% African American. And so this particular problem also was one that I was seeing was geographically rooted. So this particular sort of set of concerns is what drove me to go back and do my PhD. I completed at the University of Western Ontario. In 2009, I defended, and then I moved to the University of Michigan School of Information, and I set up a research program there that really has been focused around this question of what would health information technologies and services look like if we place the needs of marginalized groups, so communities and families, at the center of their design and implementation. So I'm trying to look at a very different kind of approach. And my real goal here is to try to improve impact and reach. So from there, I've been working on research in these three areas. I'm going to talk primarily about the first, which focuses on factors that affect health information interaction in marginalized communities and families. And just to sort of ground us, I'm working with a sociological definition of community. It's based in Max Weber's work, which is the core idea of belonging. So, and belonging is something through a lot of work sociologically and in other areas, belonging is produced a number of different ways. It's produced by geographic proximity, through institutional practices, through affect, through symbolic practices, interaction, etc. And I want to make clear that I'm working with the broadest possible conception of community. I'm actually interested in variations in kinds of communities and different forms of belonging, but the core idea there is belonging. And I also wanted to point out that a lot of my work is functioning at the mezzo level, which is between the micro level of individuals and the macro level of whole societies. And I'm focused often on communities, networks, families, organizations, etc. So the way I've approached my research is to try to vary the kinds of communities I'm studying. I mentioned that already. Also to look at a variety of different kinds of health issues, because they have different kinds of social dynamics. And also, I've been working almost exclusively through community-engaged research strategies. So typically, I'm working with nonprofits that are involved in providing services to different communities, and then they're involved in the process of priority setting around research. Often there's training and capacity building involved, etc. So, as I said to you, today, if you take away one thing from this talk, I want to say that this is a call to community health informatics, and I'll talk more about what that is as far as I see it. So I'm going to walk through some of the central findings of my work, which I believe make that case for a community health informatics approach. First, I wanted to make the point that communities have different information environments, and that that affects people's access to health information and how much they use that information. So I've done work in several contexts that demonstrate it, but I will talk about one study in particular, and that is the young men study. This focused on young men who have sex with men, so gay and bisexual, as well as people who may not identify, and is looking at HIV. And this really started with an effort to try to promote HIV testing in a very high-risk group. So the research question that drove this work is linked to that sort of core finding, is looking at community involvement and its prediction of information acquisition and use. And there is no clock in here, so.
It's right where you can't see it.
Let me just put my watch here. Okay. So the methods here were a web survey with 194 people. We also did qualitative interviews focusing on people who had high gay community involvement, and it was in southeastern Michigan. And just to let you know how I'm measuring community involvement, this is based on a measure out of Australia. Five items, good internal reliability. These are the kinds of questions you were asking. And something to know about who we were talking to, they were an average age of 20 or so, and they were majority African American, which is important given the demographics of HIV in the Detroit area. Also, because of the age, as you can see, not a lot of people had completed a university education, and the majority identified as gay. So something to know about gay community involvement, it actually wasn't associated with any demographic factors. So this really is about how much people were in touch with other people in the community, etc. And I just want to walk you through some findings. These are a series of linear regressions that predict a dependent variable mentioned at the top. And so this is drawing from some theory in the information science field, and I'm finding that in terms of social costs of information seeking, so how much you think other people will judge you for looking for information about HIV, that the more people were involved with the gay community, the less they saw there being social costs for looking for information about the disease. Network expertise accessibility. This is about people having others in their social networks who they viewed as close to them and who they could talk to about HIV and they saw as knowledgeable about the disease. People who are more involved in the gay community had more network expertise accessibility. In terms of community relevance, this is about people seeing the disease as relevant to their group. Again, more gay community involvement, the more they thought this disease was relevant to them personally. Furthermore, I was looking at incidental information acquisition. This is about people getting information without looking for it. Again, more gay community involvement, the more incidental information acquisition. Also, more gay community involvement, there was more information seeking about the disease. And looking at different mediators, we saw that these variables were all predicting information use for decision-making related to HIV. So community relevance and incidental information acquisition. The direct relationship between community involvement was completely explained by these mediating variables. So this led to the development of this model, which just came out in the Journal of Medical Internet Research in March. And this was a structural equation model. Basically, this down here means that it had good model fit. And it shows here that community involvement through these mediators this is explaining 28% of the variance in information use. As well, community involvement is affecting 9% of variance in information seeking frequency and 14% in incidental information acquisition. One thing to note that's important is the community relevance variable was actually a more important predictor of using the information than actually being exposed to it. So that's kind of an interesting fact. So those numbers are pretty good, but there was a certain amount that was still unexplained. So we then looked at our qualitative data to try to understand what was going on, what other factors might be explaining these rates of information acquisition and use. And through grounded theory, we came up with the information sharing category. And really there were certain conditions that were underlying this, mostly related to the idea of enacting pro-social community values. And people saw community as looking out for each other, and some people even saw trying to inform other people as the defining characteristic of their community. There was a number of things that people did to share information, organizing events, disseminating messages, etc. These are some quotes from young people about that. And it really seemed that this would be leading to more interaction with information long term. So for example, one of the things that was very interesting is that people who were trying to inform others then felt a need to align their own behavior with what they were telling other people to do. So that's an interesting point and sort of aligns with one of my interests around trying to create more helpers in communities than receivers. So in summary, the point here is community involvement is affecting all of these information acquisition dynamics. Also, there are specific theoretical mediators that are highlighted in this model that are relevant in the community context. Social costs of information seeking, network expertise, accessibility, and community relevance. Next finding I want to talk about is what makes an environment information rich? And here I'm going to talk about three themes that arose in some of my ethnographic work in dialysis clinics. And so here we're looking at kidney disease. And the most important thing about this was that in this environment, when we were talking to people, they saw this as an environment where they almost never even really need to ask anything because all the things they might want to know were already there, already around them. This was an information-rich environment. And so what we did in this analysis was try to find out what were the characteristics that made this information rich. This involved ethnographic observation in three dialysis clinics and interviewing patients as well. So just to give you an idea of what dialysis looks like, these are people in their, this is where the chairs are. People have a machine between them. They're mostly sitting. That's what a mechanical kidney looks like. It's a very demanding kind of treatment. And that is blood in those tubes. So it's a very uncomfortable kind of treatment. These are some of the constraints people saw. And one of the things that was really most resonant about this was people saw this as a very constraining lifestyle. And they felt rather imprisoned by the whole thing. And some of my early analyses used a theory from information science focused by Chapman, a theory of life in the round, but kind of moved beyond that to talk about these particular traits. So ambience, really how this seemed to accomplish an information-rich environment was the idea that you could interact with information in a variety of different ways. And so ambience meaning it's all around you, you're immersed. And there were a number of routines as a form of ambience with regards to ways of embedding, providing information through treatment schedules like progress updates, monthly labs, rounds of certain kinds, etc. Also, there were very routinized kinds of social greetings that were happening between people, which people found to be informing as well, especially daily greetings. And people really learned a lot through informal observation of other patients, through imitation, learning how to basically make dialysis tolerable. And there was a real kind of empirical nature to learning, very trial and error kind of approach. So one of the things that's most unique about a dialysis clinic is that a whole bunch of patients come together, they all sit together for 4 hours, and they're there three times a week, so they really get to know each other over time. And so this kind of shared experience and that kind of drawing people together led to the theme of alignment, which really is about people that share common experiences, being able to come together, and they're having common needs that lead to production of locally relevant information. And so here, the information in this committee was, or this setting, was really oriented towards trying to find a way to make dialysis tolerable, being able to basically go on. And experiential information was central to that. And so the concept of experiential information, I think, is one that Wanda has written about. But here, these findings really emphasize two aspects of experiential information. That's the strategies people develop to make dialysis tolerable, and things like how to be comfortable while you're on dialysis is a big thing. So here we have people talking about trying to stay warm, be able to be physically comfortable, how to manage cramping, things like that. Also, there was a lot of kind of stories people told each other about different clinics, and there was a certain amount of sort of almost tales that started to circulate about dialysis clinics. So for example, there was regular discussion about supposedly there was a dialysis clinic somewhere where when you sat in that chair, it would massage you. And so nobody had ever seen it, nobody had ever been to it, but this is something I think that people really wanted to know existed. Then there's the element of sort of practical strategies around how to adhere, how to manage to live with these intense restrictions, how to deal with the fact that you're on blood pressure medication, but you're continually having your blood pressure crash on dialysis. And then another aspect of experiential information that's really important is the personal story. And here we saw both kind of upward comparison around people who got kidney transplants and you're able to be inspired by that, as well as the downward comparison, which is like the cautionary tale. This is where not to go because these are people who are not doing well or they've died or something like that. And 20% of patients die each year, so this is actually an omnipresent thing. So these were two themes that were present around the idea of an information-rich environment. Then I wanted to introduce this theme of aggregation, and here this is a more incomplete kind of aggregation. And here's where we see a lot of social media opportunities and ways to try to bring people together. But this was something that worked well to some extent because people talked one-to-one with other patients. They sometimes talked in waiting rooms. But there was a lot of trouble with trying to connect with other patients because of things like huge amounts of noise, blood spatters, people falling asleep. And so there were certain kinds of barriers that really were inhibiting how much patients might be able to connect with each other. And so this is an area where working with colleagues on online peer mentoring, we've done some work with young people with kidney disease, and now we're working with trying to bring online peer mentoring to dialysis clinics. So the summary here, there are certain features of an information-rich environment. I've talked about ambience, alignment, and aggregation as something which can be improved, potentially. The next finding that I wanted to share is just this idea of previously unidentified collective patterns that are community-based. And here, I'm talking about the HOPE Project. This is a project in Flint and Genesee County area, as well as up in the Saginaw area. So these are areas that have really high prevalence of HIV and STIs, and they're mostly African American. And this is a part of a CDC-funded intervention, and I'm reporting here on a part of data collection that helped to inform the technology aspect of the intervention. So we were basically trying to find out what did people want in their particular, in an online HIV and STI prevention service. And one of the things that was surprising was we were talking to African American young people primarily, and what they talked about was not what we expected. Almost everything that they referred to had something to do with trust. And this caused us to go and think more about the sociology of trust and looking at that body of literature that really locates trust socially. It basically suggests that trust is a collective thing, that it's patterned in terms of meaning culturally, that there are a number of targets of trust, and that they might, from people to information to technologies, and that they may overlap between each other. Also, that social contexts reinforce trust. So if because you know that somebody knows people you know, you're more likely to behave in a trustworthy manner. Or if you have a long-term investment in a relationship, you're more likely to be trustworthy. So using this framework, we analyzed data from these focus groups. There were 10 of them. There were about 90 minutes. And there were 75 young people, average age of around 18. And they were all African American. And they were about 3/4 female. And because of their age, you can expect a lot of them were not done high school. So moving to findings. So here again, I'm talking about the kinds of collective patterns related to interacting with information and technology. So here, people really talked about HIV as something that was affecting their community disproportionately. They found it really upsetting, as you might expect. And they developed their own explanations as to where this was coming from. And the kind of explanation they developed had to do with the idea of morality and trust in other people. And so they had different explanations of the prevalence of the disease, which really shaped how they thought an intervention should work. So they saw, one of the biggest things in these quotes were people don't care. They don't care about themselves. They don't care about others. People are just, they just don't care. And these are people living in Flint, where people are moving out constantly, and there's a real social disinvestment, and you can see this in the kinds of things they're talking about. They also had this idea of an AIDS bad guy, somebody who's deliberately spreading the disease. They thought partners were always going to be unfaithful, they were dishonest, etc. So then, following the idea of different trust targets in sociology of trust, they also had a real kind of group trust, and they saw their social context as underlying the distrust they felt in others. So here we see a quote about people and their families feeling that it kind of was underlying people's behavior. Also, we saw this complaint here about people leaving Flint, and there was a real social disinvestment happening. Also, there was a real distrust in institutions and not trusting in their intentions, especially with regards to African Americans. You can see here the CDC, not very trusted for very obvious reasons, given the history with the community. But also people thought their doctors were very self-serving. They thought that teachers were judgmental and they hated their sex ed for the most part. Often they thought their churches were helpful, but didn't necessarily find a lot of the people there helpful. What came out best for them? Community-based organizations in terms of trust. Also, there were a lot of concerns about using information technologies, especially about dealing with HIV or STIs. And probably the things that surprised me the most at the time, I talked to Sherry about this earlier today, people not necessarily having control of their cell phones. So other people have them, and then they're really afraid of what messages they might get. I don't know if it's that they were being stolen. Sometimes people talk about them being stolen, but I don't know if it was like a sharing practice. But not people don't necessarily have their cell phone all the time. Also, there was a lot of gossip, fighting, rumors, things like that online. There were people who, like this young woman here, under fighting, just completely disowned participating in things like Facebook or MySpace, which actually was still popular there. And that's because they just thought it was a place of negativity. They just wanted to stay away from it. Also, somewhat disturbingly, there was a lot of distrust in prevention kinds of technologies. People, and this seems to link back to the school-based sexuality education people were getting, the abstinence only until marriage approach, which basically emphasizes condom failure rather than success. And young people were basically left utterly confused about whether they were effective. They thought maybe they weren't, so they didn't necessarily trust condoms. Some people did, but it was very mixed. Also, the idea of HIV tests, people didn't really understand the idea of a window period. They didn't understand how long they were accurate and things like that. So people didn't necessarily trust these technologies or understand them. And there were also issues related to trust and information. People didn't necessarily trust the official information they were getting from public health units. So this is somebody not believing about how HIV is transmitted. And also, in a kind of environment where official information is not trusted, the work on sociology of rumor suggests that there will be a lot of rumors arising. And there was a real reliance on that. People spread rumors, and they believe rumors, and this was for them a way of being able to try to protect themselves. Because if you don't trust in technologies, if you don't trust the information you're getting, well, the best thing to do is to avoid the person who's going to cause you harm. And that was really what people saw as the way that they could protect themselves. So they wanted things like, registries of people with HIV positive. They said, we're not going to do that in our intervention, but this is the kind of thing people wanted. So I'm hoping that I've persuaded you through this that trust is something that can have a collective basis. We saw here trust being applied to many different aspects of issues that might affect an intervention. Also, in terms of the collective basis of trust, that is connected to a system of meaning. And this is something that we see in other areas as well with this population. And also that there's a carryover of trust between different levels. And that's one of the sort of fundamental insights of the sociology of trust. So I'm hoping you will come away from this thinking about trust from a collective perspective, and trust in information and technologies is something that may be different depending on the group you're working with. Okay, and the final finding that I want to share with you concerns contentious and antagonistic interactions that can emerge as people are interacting with health information in communities and families. So we saw a little taste of that when we were looking at the kind of fighting and rumor and things like that circulating in Flint. But now I want to talk about families. So I have a project that's following families over a two-year period that are dealing with chronic illness. And they were sampled by family group. I'm looking at a group level, the kinds of information activities they were engaged in. And just so you know the methods, it was a cluster sampling approach. So a patient enrolled in the study, and then they brought their family members in. And we didn't define family for them. They chose their own definition. So there are some people who are close friends, things like that. And we're following them over 2 years. And there are a number of methods being used. There's 5 contacts with the families. There are qualitative individual interviews at the beginning and end. A modification of a focus group method in the middle, which is the whole the family group interviews. And we're also doing some work with home tours and network analysis surveys over time. So, and this is an idea of some of the methods that we're using. Data collection is ongoing for this project, I will emphasize. We are now at time 5 interviews with these families. There are 32 families in the study, 83 individuals. A lot of people couldn't get really big family groups. We have one group that's 6 people, one group that's 5, but a lot of them just have one other person who's really involved in their care. And as you can see, we have good representation of African Americans, but it's majority white. And the mean age for these two diseases, it's people with diabetes or HIV and their family members. The HIV folks are a little younger. Makes sense given the demographics of the disease. And there are more males involved in the HIV group and more females involved in the diabetes group. And about a quarter of people have high school education or less. The majority of the families that we have are low income. So this is the sort of connection around marginalized populations. So there were examples of what would be called support. The social support literature in health psychology talks about informational support. We did see that. Things like people helping others achieve their goals, carrying email forwards when there was new science and things like that. So there was some of that. But there was also negative family responses to illness, especially for people with HIV. PHA means person with HIV or AIDS. And here we were seeing this a lot more. Families that were silent about the disease, people who were estranged from families, etc. But one of the things that sort of was striking and I didn't expect in this study was the kind of negative interactions people were having about health, especially around attempted influence. So keep in mind, we have people with diabetes and their family members in this study. And there were a lot of skirmishes around snacks, really. I mean, people didn't necessarily feel that they could eat without being judged, and there was a lot of kind of reinforcement of messages and people trying to influence each other. And this is an example about too much caring. Patients often felt criticized or infantilized by their family members who were trying to inform them. This is an example of somebody who is basically rebelling by eating 2 donuts instead of 1 because of the critiques. And we also saw a lot of unwanted interference, especially with healthcare providers or people sharing information about other people's health status with others, and they were annoyed. And a lot of kind of claims to other people in families, and so a lot of boundary overstepping that people talked about. And here we saw issues related to family members trying to get information from healthcare providers that patients didn't want to be on the agenda. Okay, so I just wanted to give you a taste of that work. And basically to make the case that, yes, there is positive information sharing with families related to health, but also there's this dark side, one could say. And actually that was what we heard about the most, which was quite surprising, especially when people got alone, when they were in groups, they were a lot more, they liked each other a lot more, but they didn't like each other as much if they were apart. So I wanted to hear her making the argument that information sharing or different kinds of technological interventions that might put families working together around health may not necessarily be supportive or helpful if one considers this potential dark side. And in the field of information science, there's a whole tradition of defining information itself as a form of help, and I'm sort of suggesting that that's not always the case. So to conclude, this has been a call to community health informatics, and why? I've shown you that communities can have different access to information, and this might affect how they use that information. I've shown you that there are certain characteristics in an environment which might facilitate access to information more better than others. I've shown you that there are a number of collective patterns. Here I talked about trust, but in my studies there are a number of other things that have arisen. And also that there can be contentious and antagonistic interactions. And all of these things, I believe, cause us to start to think about intervention at a community or a family level. And there's a tradition of this kind of work in the field of public health and social work. In nursing, there's a whole sort of family intervention area. But there really hasn't been that kind of an approach in health informatics to a great degree. And I wanted to suggest that we might think about, based on these studies, a few things or ways of intervening. So I'm suggesting some alternate approaches. So building information-rich environments, using these kinds of themes, there are roles or places where technology could potentially play a role. In terms of theoretical mediators, going back to that model with young men who have sex with men, a lot of the social contact in this community that's happening is online. And so that is a very natural way to work with this community and to look at trying to affect these variables which affect access to information and information use. And also I've presented an idea related to trust-centered design. And this is linked to a JAMIA paper that's online before print. It should be coming out very soon. And this particular approach, I've put together in a schema. I can talk more about this later. But essentially, this operationalizes a kind of approach that one could take to try to build trust in a health informatics intervention when working with groups that with whom you need to intentionally cultivate trust. The specifics and the particulars in each category might change depending on the group you're working with, but essentially this operationalizes the idea of multi-level trust, so institutions, technologies, groups, individuals, and it also looks at the context of intervention strategy, functionality, etc. I can talk more about that later if you like. But in terms of trust-centered design, for my specific context, that Flint context, those young people who were struggling so much, these are the kinds of things that we are trying to operationalize in that context. So the idea of connection to an offline world, being very planful about connections to people that they already trust. And that's really important when people are not necessarily trusting other people on technologies. Also looking at the issue of axiological trust and the morality people were complaining about, giving people some tools in order to try to refer to behaviors that are safer sex behaviors and trying to communicate norms in a new way through new kinds of aggregation. And also giving people tools to voluntarily submit themselves to group accountability. So to make public commitments and things like that. And then also giving people tools for organizing around the issue that they really care about. So just going to wrap up now. So some of the areas that I'm working on in the future, I have a paper that's in press that looks at information acquisition and use in the context of health decisions, and actually found that information exposure and use were more important than traditional theory of and behavior constructs in predicting the intention to get an HIV test. Also working on trying to further develop concepts around what would a community or family level intervention be or look like, and also working on instantiating some of these concepts in interventions and evaluating them. And there's some ongoing projects that are working on these things. I can talk about any of them. So I wanted to conclude though. So I told you about how I came to this work, the kind of question that's motivating what I'm doing, the four central findings that I think are making the case for community health informatics. I talked about some of the ideas about ways these could be instantiated in community or family level interventions. I wanted to thank funders of this work and collaborators and to invite your questions. Thank you so much for your attention.
We have a few minutes for questions.
I don't know who put that in.
So one of the things I find in professional or paraprofessional circles when I'm talking about misconceptions or pseudoscience that's been prevalent among a lot of people believing is that if people take it as a personal attack when you try to say, okay, let's talk about the facts. And I'm wondering, have they been taught that they have to always be right? And if you're saying that this information's wrong, they project it onto themselves? Or I'm wondering where the personal attack feeling comes from.
So I don't know if I can speak about specifically personal attacks, but I'm just inferring that whomever is saying this might be perceived as an outsider. And if that is true, it's more likely to be seen as confrontational if somebody's seen as an outsider. I'd say also that sometimes the way that we communicate different facts sometimes doesn't necessarily connect as well to people's pre-existing beliefs as maybe they could or should. So, for example, in my work in rural Canada around HIV, the underlying beliefs around faith and HIV transmission in some communities were very pronounced. And in order to try to reach some people, so for example, I interviewed a couple, this is not any of the work I've talked about today, but the woman was positive, the man was negative, and they refused to engage in safer sex because they believed God would stop transmission. In that kind of a situation, they had healthcare providers telling them over and over again, don't do this, don't do this, this is a bad decision to make, blah, blah, blah. But if somebody didn't find a way of connecting to that underlying belief, there was just they weren't going to be listening. And so I think that there's a certain amount of understanding a process of translation of information into a local community that maybe we need to better work with.
Do you have any references where people have undertaken that process of translation?
I'd say the work that's focused on peer-based interventions, especially with young people around HIV, STIs, is probably the best example I've seen of that work. But there's also a whole body of work around community health workers. Are you familiar with that work?
No.
Or promotoris? So they're in public health, there's a tradition of training people who come from a particular community to disseminate messages, especially around things like cancer screening and stuff like that. A lot of them are sort of Latin American communities, hence the name promotoris. Yes?
I was really intrigued by the trust construct and thinking about the developmental stage of the young people. Mm-hmm. And so I'm kind of wondering, young teens mm-hmm. would be at a point where they might be dealing with trust issues regardless of mm-hmm. their health information mm-hmm. needs or status. But wondering if you see that translates to other groups, older, mm-hmm. younger, or...
So in the paper, we've been extremely careful not to claim generalizability beyond young African Americans. So, but I will say that I think trust is an issue that could arise in many marginalized populations. And so if it's a situation where trust needs to be intentionally cultivated, then I suggest a kind of trust-centered design approach. Developmentally, perhaps.
Marginal.
And as I said, the specifics in that model might change depending on the health issue or the community context, et cetera. Rupa.
Do you view the work, it's really interesting, findings. Do you view the work as something where you're engaging in trust-centered design yourself, or do you have to get them to trust you to open up? And in what ways is that something that you can advise people who want to work with marginalized populations?
So the trust-centered design sort of construct is something that is sort of in my thinking come to more recently, but I've been very influenced by community-based participatory research as an approach. That's actually how I got involved in going back to do my PhD, as I was a community-based partner in HIV research. And so because I sort of come from a community-based sector, and I've been known through that, there's a kind of, it's very natural for me to connect with organizations. But I don't typically go to a community and say, hi, I want to serve you. I usually try to work with established infrastructures or partnerships that exist already. And one of the things I found is patience is really important. So this project here, Enhancing the Community Health Information Infrastructure, this is not one I talked about, but it's in Flint, Inkster, in Detroit. And in that work, we're meeting for 2 years and talking about what the issues are and doing some data collection to start with. And I mean, there are certain decisions that we need to make that are very slow because we want to do the engagement, or I want to do the engagement in a way that is respectful and actually reflects what the needs are. So it's typically working with an intermediary, and you have to choose your partners well, that you may know. And I'd say also, community presence is actually a really important part of building trust. So doing things like showing up for the fundraiser of a nonprofit, or you know, being somebody who, I've ended up mentoring a lot of people who are interested in Flint or in other communities that are interested in maybe going back to school and doing a PhD. And you know, that's kind of off the books kind of mentoring, but it's the kind of thing that can bring diverse communities into the university context and stuff like that. So I'd say approaching it as a whole person, getting involved, and you know, you can smell insincerity a mile away. So, you know, think about why you want to do it, and you know, I hope I've answered your question. Yes, sure.
I have a follow-on to what Rupa asked. The question, you haven't mentioned the word library or librarian, I think. Where in the trust infrastructure have you found, or have you not found, libraries and librarians?
Around HIV, typically libraries are fairly marginal, mostly because people do not necessarily trust the confidentiality of libraries. So whether it's using terminals that peers are available there, whether it's talking to a librarian, they're not sure about confidentiality requirements with librarians. Very, very marginal in that area. But in the area of diabetes, kidney disease, hypertension, in Inkster, Flint, and Detroit, this first project here, I'm actually working with public libraries as well as public health and other kinds of organizations, nonprofits, etc., healthcare providers. And in those communities, we have IMLS funding, and I think that libraries will become a springboard of what we do next.
Because when surveys are done of professional groups that are trustworthy, not necessarily with marginalized populations, but just in general, librarians usually rank really high in that trust framework. So I was just curious about. But I can understand the HIV/AIDS and particularly a marginalized community. Because it's part of the infrastructure.
Yes.
You know, libraries and librarians. So.
I think another component is that people typically turn to people, other human beings, for information. And I mean, I'm part of what I've been advocating in the information science field is a network-based approach to intervention, which would involve things like connecting with pre-existing networks as a professional who's kind of there as a facilitator. Joining committees where community groups are doing work. There's work of that nature already happening, but trying to build on that. So, yes?
Comment on
the
last question.
Last word,
Could you comment, please, on how this might look to a person like myself as a family doc who might have a portal and trying to design a portal around the trust architecture, assuming people who repeatedly come back to me have some trust already. So this isn't speaking to marginalized groups so much as it is to the population.
So down here, user needs and intervention objectives. I've been suggesting, obviously, institutional affiliation is really important. So assuming people trust you already, that you would have that covered. Participation, though, I think is a critical aspect of trust building at a technological level. So trying to figure out how to engage people, how to reflect their needs and experiences, to give them things they actually want and will use. And then network embeddedness as a component. So potentially looking at, you as a physician probably are part of their networks and maybe that would be enough, but there might be key people in the community or network that are already widely trusted, and that might be another way to think about how to intervene. And the contents of what the intervention might look like might be different depending on what you're trying to do. So that's your question.
Good, thank you.
So everybody join me in thanking Tiffany again.
Thanks. Thank you.
Who has a sign-up sheet?
Oh, well, not a sheet.
We have a sign-up sheet.